From the latest on Caribbean cruises to kosher safaris, pilgrimages to Jewish Eastern Europe and award-winning wines and international cuisine in sun-drenched Tel Aviv. Sit back and enjoy the trip with the travel edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the latest edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast travel edition. And it's a bit different today, David.
We have been brave. Now that everybody is maskless, we've come out of our studio and we are in Tel Aviv.
Oh, that ruined the quiz. The question was, can you guess where we're recording from?
We've come to Sarona, which way back in the 19th century was built by Templar Christians. And if you come here, there are two and three story houses that are pretty much, or at least look as though they are in the original format, but they have been modernized into what has become an incredibly wonderful family and also in the evenings young person's paradise.
And we're sat in the shadow of three very large towers where people live, and to the entrance of Sarona Market, which is full of little market stalls and chef-run restaurants.
Certainly, if you are planning a trip to Israel, and obviously Tel Aviv, this is a place that is very central, right next to the bus stations, next to one of the main train stations, railroad station. Well worth a visit for 2-3 hours, I would have thought.
And looking in front of me, I can see Israel's tallest building, which is the Azrieli Spiral Tower, which also overlooks Sarona. It's a real sign of the modern changed Israel.
But for today's podcast, we're actually not going to be talking about Sarona and Tel Aviv, but we thought it would just be nice to bring you a little bit more of the sounds and tastes of this area. So where are we headed this time around, Mark?
In this episode, we're heading to Lviv in the Ukraine and to the Museum of Fine Art in Boston.
As we always do, we're going to start with a couple of quiz questions that will put you in mood for our trips to Lviv and Boston.
Thank you, David, for this one. Question number one. What did pharmacists Mikko Liasha and researchers Johann Zegg and Ignasty Lukasiewicz invent in 1853 in Lviv?
Very well done. I'm not going to tell people how many times we edited out your mispronunciations. Good. Question number two. Which stretch of Boston sand was the first public beach in the United States established in 1896?
We'll give you the answers at the end of the pod.
Now we've come inside the Sarona Market, and at this time in the evening, it is just awash with young people. Here in Israel right now, people are able to come out once they're in the restaurants and cafes. They take off their masks and sit and party the night away. There are cheese stands, fish stalls. There are health food places, there are homemade beer stands. You name it, you can find it here in the Sarona Market. Very much the emphasis on the boutique.
This time last year, David and I had planned a trip, starting in Krakow in Poland and ending up in Odessa in the Ukraine. And one of our stops on the trip was Lviv, which is on the border between Poland and Ukraine. One of the main reasons we were going to Lviv is David had family that descend from a place called Busk, which is around an hour outside Lviv. Unfortunately, due to Corona, we were unable to make this trip. So we're going to try and live the trip vicariously by talking to Peter Outhouse from Lviv Buddy Tours.
I run a tour company here. We do all kinds of tours in Lviv and Western Ukraine. We have a special focus on Jewish clients because I'm personally also very much interested in Jewish history, although I'm not Jewish myself. And that's become my main business here in Ukraine, although due to Corona, a little bit less right now.
David and I were planning to be in Lviv a few months ago, and we hope to come next year. One of the debates we had along the way was, is it Lviv or Lvov? We had an argument about this. I mean, you've said Lviv.
It's in Ukraine nowadays. So, I mean, I would always recommend people to go with Lviv because that's what you would say in Ukrainian. However, There are definitely, you know, historical references to the other names, although you're referring to the Russian version of it, which is the least good alternative, because basically, you know, the only affiliation people here had with Russia was when the occupation of the Soviet Union was here, and that was only from World War II until 1991, and people don't particularly like this here. You could call it Lvov, because that's the Polish name of it, and actually it bore that name for about 400 years, like as a city in Poland or in the Polish kingdom. And then it also was 140 years Austrian. So you could also call it Lemberg, which is the German name for it.
What are the Jewish highlights of Lviv that one can see on your walking tour?
My absolute favorite place here in Lviv, which I like to show to Jewish people, is the Jakob Glanzer Schule. That's actually a Hasidic synagogue that was built in the 1840s. It turned into a carpenter's workshop, or, well, kind of like a storage place during World War II. And that's how it actually survived. And after the war, it was actually the only synagogue that was used for the Jewish community of Lviv that was left here after the war. And it was used as such until the 1960s. Then the Soviets actually turned it into a gym of a polygraphic institute here in the city. And that's what it was used until the late 1980s. And actually that place was, in the whole of the Soviet Union, the second place that was returned to a Jewish community, because as you might know, Soviet Union was an atheist state. And so basically religion wasn't very well seen, but under Gorbachev, Glasnost, Perestroika, they actually returned some of the synagogues to the Jewish communities. And this was the second one in the Soviet Union at all, after Vilnius. And Vilnius actually just was 1 week before that.
Are there any other Jewish highlights on the tour, or is it just really the focus on that synagogue?
There is, for example, places where, you know, there was a Yiddish-speaking theater here in the city, which was actually very famous in Eastern Europe. We have a lot of houses of artists, of journalists, and also, of course, places that are related to the Holocaust, where we tell the whole story of what happened here during the Shoah. There is a lot of things to see, because what you have to keep in mind is that in World War II, this was a city of about 350,000 people, and a third of these people were Jewish.
You don't only do tours focusing on the Jewish community and history. What else can people see in the city?
Lviv has quite a long history. It was founded in the year 1256. And in these years, you know, there is a lot of heritage that came together here. So it was built by German townspeople, basically, in the medieval times. Then it was ruled by the Polish kingdom. And there is a lot of Polish heritage here, but there were also Armenians. There were all kinds of like different cultures that came together here and kind of built all some buildings. You know, we have an Armenian church, for example, and these kind of things. And it's just this kind of multicultural background that the city has makes it so really diverse. That's one thing. Then you have the Museum of Folk Architecture, which is really nice. It's basically like a reconstruction of farmhouses that they took apart, like in some villages in Western Ukraine. And then they built it together back here. Then we have the Lichakiv Cemetery, which is actually called sometimes the Père Lachaise of the East. So Père Lachaise, you know, the cemetery where Jim Morrison is buried in Paris. People call this the Père Lachaise of the East. And it's actually very beautiful. It's especially if it's a bit foggy, you know, it's very mystic. There's also the Opera House, of course. You can actually go to get the best seats for less than €20 or $20, something like this, which is fantastic. There is also the House of Scientists, which has an amazing wooden staircase. It's, you know, one of the most photographed places in the city, and actually very, very popular with wedding couples that go there and just take their wedding photos there.
What is the best way to go and visit villages outside Lviv?
Some of them only have like a bus connection. If you come from abroad, it's a bit of an adventure. So I wouldn't usually recommend it to, let's say, the average American tourist because, you know, forget about air condition or any other luxury on these kind of buses. I mean, you can get even by public transport to most places in Lviv Oblast. You know, it's just a matter of question how flexible you are. If you don't want to bother with this kind of stuff, there might be a train if it's a bit bigger. If that doesn't work, then it's absolutely fine to rent a car here. Driving is chaotic, but having been to Israel before, I know that, you know, you're probably used to quite a lot from there as well. You got to be a bit careful because, I mean, they're not in the very best conditions. There are still quite a few potholes, especially if you go like to really the countryside here. But the major highways, they're all fine. We also, as a company, actually offer this kind of services when you're looking for like ancestors or something. Then we work with people who do research for you. And we also, of course, I mean, I drive myself. I have my own car and can take you there. On the other hand, I can also supply people if you just need a taxi, basically, you know, to bring you there and back and have someone wait for you.
Where can people get more details of your tours?
Most of the information about our tours we actually have on our website. There are so many possibilities and tours that we could offer. And I mean, I got to say, maybe I'm a bit too lazy to write them all down. So whenever people have a request, just because it's not on the website doesn't mean we don't offer it.
And the website address, the URL is Lviv, LVIVbuddy.com, LvivBuddy.com. Peter Althaus from Lviv Buddy, it's been a fascinating tour de force of your city or the city that you have adopted. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I hope to see you soon here in the city.
Lviv Fact File. Lviv has an international airport with direct flights to many European destinations, including Berlin, Paris, London, Munich, Vienna, Warsaw, Istanbul, Rome, Vilnius, and Copenhagen. There are no direct flights from the US or Canada. Direct flights to Tel Aviv via Ukraine International Airlines and SkyUp. Car rentals are available at the airport and cost around $40 to $50 per day for an economy vehicle. There are also direct trains to Lviv from Krakow, Warsaw, Budapest, Vienna, and of course from all major cities in Ukraine. It's also easy to reach the Carpathian Mountains from Lviv by train. In the city, there are trolley buses that go to the university directly for around 30 cents, but taxis, Uber and Bolt are available for journeys from $2 to $4. Peter recommends the following hotels. At 5-star level, the Grand Hotel Lviv and the Leopolis. For a lower budget, Peter recommends the George Hotel, the Vintage Boutique Hotel and the On the Square Guest House. The currency is the Ukrainian hryvnia. 100 hryvnia will cost you $3.50. Cafe Jerusalem is the Jewish style restaurant near Lichakiv Cemetery. There is also Cafe Atlas, Trapenza Ide, Puzata Hata, and Baluvana Halia. Great places to try traditional Ukrainian food.
And now it's time for the latest travel news brought to you by the Jerusalem Post podcast, Travel Edition. Up to 47% of Thailand's hotels could go out of business within 3 months. A survey from the Bank of Thailand puts that down to the country's third coronavirus wave, causing a major reduction in hotel occupancy.
Getting from the US to Tel Aviv has never been easier. Over the next month, United Airlines will add 4 weekly flights from New York and Newark, 6 from Chicago O'Hare and 3 from San Francisco. El Al is adding another 13 flights per week to New York, Miami and Los Angeles. And with American Airlines also returning to Israel after a 5-year hiatus, this summer will see as many as 86 weekly flights between Israel and the US.
Azerbaijan is planning to open in Israel a tourism promotion office with diplomatic status.
Israeli tourists will be allowed to enter the UK freely starting May the 17th. London's decision follows a similar announcement from the EU, which recommended travel restrictions for Israeli tourists be lifted in all member states.
And as Tunisia faces a third wave of COVID, hundreds of Jewish pilgrims were still able to travel to the ancient Kiryat Arba synagogue on the island of Djerba for the annual Lag BaOmer pilgrimage.
We've now moved across Sirona and we're stood outside a bar called Lager and Ale. There isn't a seat to be had here, there's a queue coming out of the bar, which is a shame because I'm quite parched.
That's a signal that you should remain with iced water, like those of us who are the designated drivers.
I think I'll rely on public transport here because we are right next to the train station and buses. Very easily accessible for when you've had a couple of lagers.
Away from Mark's alcoholism and the merriment of Sirona, we're going to take you now across to Boston. And this journey actually begins in Lviv, where we were just a short while ago in Ukraine, and earlier it was in Poland. And a very special piece of art that has found its way from Lviv to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. To find out more about it, we spoke with Simona DiNepi, who's the Charles and Lynn Schusterman Curator of Judaica at the museum.
My job is to build, to study and display a collection of Jewish art. I've been in this position for just over 3 years. I'm actually originally from Rome, but I left Rome 28 years ago now, and I lived many years in London and in Israel, where I worked and I studied, and I worked in different museums, not always Judaica, old masters, but always in curatorial roles.
Tell us a little bit about the history of this collection, the Judaica collection, and the Schusterman side of things.
So in 2010, there is this first important acquisition. And in the same year, I think it's important to mention it, something extraordinary happened. The museum learned that a woman they had never heard of, her name was Jetskalina Phillips, left a bequest for the study, acquisition, and display of Judaica. And we still, thanks to the Phillips Fund and this bequest, we were able to build a collection. Sadly, no one was able to meet this woman and thank her. But she really had clearly a vision. She cared about the museum. Then 3 years later, another extraordinary, generous woman. And this is, it's interesting because the Judaica story at the MFA, I think it's really the story of two very generous women with a great vision. So Lynn Schusterman of Oklahoma, of Tulsa, who's a known philanthropist, she gave the MFA about 120 objects of Judaica from her own collection. And so she really allowed us to form a core collection from which we could really build on, which is what we've been doing, especially in the past few years. Only in the past 3 years, we made 30 new acquisitions in different periods, different geographic areas, different materials. But I think without Jetskalina Phillips and Lynn Schusterman, we wouldn't have been able to do any of this, I think.
So for you, why is it so important that the museum has this Judaica collection?
First of all, we have to understand that, like the British Museum or the Met or the Louvre, the MFA in its nature is what it has an encyclopedic aspiration, and it's one of the greatest, finest, and largest encyclopedic collections in the world. And like the Met, it only recently got to Judaica, and we can wonder about why that is. But I think it's important because, like any other artwork, whether it's a Renaissance painting or a Buddhist sculpture, for example, first of all, for its aesthetic value, so the fact that it shows the skill, the craftsmanship of an artist, for its beauty, because in particular, Judaica has an explicit purpose of hidur mitzvah, of enhancement of the mitzvah through beauty, the beautification of the mitzvah. But also for those that are less perhaps sensitive to the aesthetic element of Judaica, again, like any other artwork, it speaks to us. It tells us so much about the period in which it was made, the values, the beliefs, sometimes even the fears of you know, of the culture in which was made. And of course, in the special and extraordinary thing about Judaica in particular, and I think that's why I'm privileged, there isn't really one Judaica. There are so many Judaicas, whether it's Moroccan or German or Italian, there isn't one. So every object speaks of the culture and the beliefs, you know, and the concerns of the period when it was made, the person who made them, the people who used it. Of course, it's even more the case with Judaica because these objects were used in our everyday life. So they were very close to us. They were part of, you know, they still are part of our life. So
the museum made headlines in December last year when it spent about $1.3 million on a single piece of Judaica for the collection. Can you tell us about this important new acquisition?
It's a Torah shield, in Hebrew, a tas. So it is a shield or a breastplate that hangs through chains on the front of a Torah scroll, as if it were a necklace to sort of decorate it. What you're seeing is actually the front and the back of the same object. They're entirely filled and with decoration. And this is very unusual. The fact that a Torah shield that is meant to only be seen from the front should be decorated at all on the back, that is rare already. Here, it's not only decorated, it is fully engraved with narrative, figurative scenes, in particular from the life of Isaac. So, A, it's decorated on both sides in very different ways, different techniques. And B, it is completely filled with narrative scenes as if it were a book. So that's one of the reasons why it's so rare and exceptional. The other reason is that the listeners can imagine that under these narrative scenes that are encased in a beautiful, fanciful Rococo, very extravagant frames, you have on top the binding of Isaac, the moment of the sacrifice of Isaac. Underneath, there is a scene of Isaac blessing Jacob, and underneath, there is more decoration. Now, at the very bottom, there is what makes this work so valuable and important, and it is a full signature by the artist that tells us that in 5,542, meaning 1781/82 of the Gregorian calendar. This is the work by the hands of Elimelech Tzoref. Tzoref means silversmith of war, of course, of Stanislav. Stanislav, it's a little town, probably 1 or 2 hours from Lviv. And so today it's part of Ukraine as well. This signature is very, very rare because normally the way that silversmiths sign their work is with a silver mark, with their initial. You normally would have a number of silver marks that tell us the date, the place where it was made, and the silversmith who made it. The fact that it is made by a Jewish silversmith should not be taken for granted at all. And just to give you an idea, this is the first major work of Judaica made by a Jewish silversmith that enters our collection. And I stress the word major. We have other two words, but they're not signed. Because in Europe, broadly speaking, except for, you know, exceptions in a few pockets of Europe, Jews were not allowed into the guilds, the silversmiths guilds. At this time, in this part of Eastern Europe, Poland, actually, Galicia in particular, which is the area, of course, between Poland and Ukraine, there was a period when Jews were allowed to practice the profession. But this is very exciting because it breaks the narrative, unfortunately, the narrative that I have to give when I explain our collection, that generally speaking, these great masterpieces for Jewish use were actually made by Christian silversmiths. Another aspect is the fact that it came from the private collection of the celebrated Sassoon family of Baghdad, normally known as the Rothschilds of the East, but they were, I think, so much more powerful than the Rothschilds. They had a real international trade empire. So anything that comes from their collection, from the Sassoons, has an added value, you know, very, very prestigious provenance.
Let's get to some practical details, because this is something fascinating that is clearly worth seeing, in addition to everything else in your collection. So how long can somebody spend in the museum? Where is the museum located, and how do people get there? All that in one answer.
The MFA, because it is a very large encyclopedic collection, I suppose that there are two ways to go about it, as if, you know, you go to the Louvre. Either you decide that you spend the day and you pick a very specific part of the history of art that you're interested in, or you have to spend a few days. I'll start with the more practical aspects. It's very easy to get to because it's fairly centrally located. It's on a broad avenue called Huntington Avenue, which is just actually 25 minutes walk from Copley Square, one of, you know, the main central squares of Boston. What's good is that it's across the road from another important museum, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, so that, you know, if you go to the MFA, then you can, you know, go across the road to go to the Isabella Stewart Gardner as well. The MFA has an extraordinary collection. It is particularly strong in, I'd say, you know, Greek and Roman, and actually new galleries are just being made now and will open in the fall, Egyptian and Nubian art, and two new galleries have just opened a few weeks ago. And this is because the MFA was, together with Harvard, around 1904, one of the first organizations to actually go and expedition to the pyramids. So they really went there very, very early. And it has, I think, outside of Egypt and Turin, where there is the Egyptian Museum, an incredible collection. Very strong on French Impressionists. Imagine just by Monet, by Claude Monet, we have 35 oil paintings just at the MFA. At the moment, there is an exhibition about Monet in Boston. Asian, very strong in Japanese and Chinese. Dutch. I'm probably forgetting something, but we have a lot of competitors, as you can see, at Judaica, because these collections are world-class, leading in their field. And we have only recently begun, but I think we are trying to make progress quickly.
Simona Dinepi, the Schusterman Curator of Judaica at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope to see you at the MFA when we're back on site.
Boston Fact File. There are normally direct flights between Boston and Tel Aviv three times a week with El Al. There are direct flights to Boston from all major European destinations and US cities. The easiest ways from Logan Airport are the Silver Line Rapid Bus Transport, which is free to South Station, and the Blue Line subway, which is the best connection to the Orange Line at State Street Station. Simona recommends the Lenox Hotel near Boston Public Library, around a 25-minute walk from the museum, and the Revere Hotel near Boston Common, which is 35 minutes away. The kosher Milk Street Cafe in the downtown area has been open since 1981. There's also a good selection of vegetarian Indian places. In the Brookline suburb, there are several kosher restaurants, including Vittorio's Grill, Rami's, Pure Cold Press and Veg Crust, as well as restaurants in Newton, Jamaica Plain, and kosher outlets at Harvard, Tufts, Brandeis, and MIT.
And as our mini outing to Tel Aviv draws to a close, I'd like to say a massive thank you to Peter and Simona. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to subscribe, give us a 5-star rating and write a nice positive review. And don't forget to share it with your friends.
And now it's time for the quiz answers. Earlier in the show, we asked you question number one. What did pharmacist Mikoli Asher and researchers Johann Zeg and Ignacy Lukasiewicz invent in 1853 in Lviv? The answer was the kerosene or oil lamp.
And question number two, which stretch of Boston Sand was the first public beach in the United States established in 1896? And the answer is Revere Beach.
And here's a useless fact for the day. That's where my other half's grandmother grew up, right on the beach.
Fascinating. fascinating.
Absolutely. There was a Jewish community there. Maybe we'll do a piece about that in one of our upcoming editions of the Jerusalem Post podcast travel edition. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.